From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Sports, politics, and patriotism. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Colin Kaepernick took a knee instead of saluting the flag. Will he ever play again in the National Football League? Greg Popovich has called the president a soulless coward. Will he still be coaching in NBA basketball? It's often claimed that sports are separate from politics, but that's a far cry from reality, especially in this era of hyper-partisanship. Men and women athletes, fans and owners, from sold-out stadiums to high school fields and gymnasiums, are all getting into the action. Later on today's Talking Point, Masha Gessen brings Americans a warning from Moscow. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. National Football League team owners are meeting today to craft a unified message about political protest. Men and women athletes in other sports are protesting too. We'll hear how Colin Kaepernick's refusal to stand for the flag has demonstrated the inseparable relationship between sports and politics. Today's talking point, the Soviet Union may have collapsed, but without enough economic or political reform to make Russia a new and different country. Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen says Vladimir Putin has used leftover institutions to increase his power and that Americans should be paying attention. First, this news update. With the backing of American power, Kurdish and Arab forces may have destroyed the city of Raqqa in order to save it. They claim that ISIS finally has been dislodged from what used to be called its capital city. Liz Sly covers Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon for The Washington Post. Always good to have you on our program.
Hello, Warren.
I take it there's not much left of Raqqa.
Well, like all the cities that have been retaken from ISIS, what we're seeing is that devastated wastelands are being recaptured after the battles, and that there isn't much left of the cities once they are once ISIS has been driven out.
Who are with the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF that we're talking about, that work with American backing? Who are those people?
Well, this is primarily a group called the YPG, which is a Kurdish group that has taken control over much of northeastern Syria. And it's a group with a very leftist ideology that that adheres to the teachings of a Turkish Kurd who's in prison in Turkey. And that is why Turkey has been so unhappy with the U.S. policy there. Now, they have brought on board a substantial number of Arabs who have participated in this fight, and Raqqa is a wholly Arab city, or almost wholly Arab city, and that was why it was important to get some Arabs on board with this project to create something called the SDF.
What was the American role?
The American role was substantial. Without the first of all, the YPG did not want to take Raqqa at all, because it is not a Kurdish city, it is an Arab city, and their project is to create a Kurdish homeland in the north of Syria, in the Kurdish areas. And so the Americans kind of nudged them, prodded them, persuaded them to take Raqqa. They also provided them with huge quantities of weaponry to do that. The YPG would not have had the capacity to do it without American help. They also provided very intense airstrikes, and they have had advisors on the ground in the form of special forces who have been there on the front lines at every stage of this battle.
In a radio broadcast today, here is a claim made by President Trump.
I totally changed rules of engagement. I totally changed our military. I totally changed the attitudes of the military, and they have done a fantastic job.
Liz Sly, back to you. Do you hear that from American military people in the field, or for that matter, from Kurds and others?
Well, what we have seen is that since the Trump administration came into power, and it's not clear that some of these tweaks to the policy weren't made in the last days of the Obama administration, because the Mosul offensive was going very slowly, and they were getting a bit worried about that. And they, I think that the rules of engagement were tweaked a lot, or at least not a lot, but a little in the last days of the Obama administration. But what we've seen under Trump is a real subcontracting of the war to the military. The White House has not got involved in the day-to-day decisions on the ground. The Obama administration was very concerned about civilian casualties, and airstrikes had to go through a long approval process, which sometimes meant that they came too late to make a difference, or that troops on the ground were caught without air support because they couldn't get approval for the strikes. And this is why we've seen a sharp increase in the number of civilian casualties caused in these battles as well, because the military has been striking where it needs to in a military sense, but without having to run up a chain of command to get assessments of whether there might be civilians in the area or not.
Okay, obviously another side of the story. Tell us, how totally defeated is ISIS, and particularly just not just in Raqqa, but elsewhere?
Well, at the moment, they're looking pretty defeated. They are not putting up much of a fight anywhere that they are still defending. There is an area spanning the Iraqi-Syrian border. It's mostly desert. That's where they are concentrated right now. But they've been losing ground there quite rapidly as well to advancing Syrian government forces. And it really looks like they're giving up the fight in most places. They did put up a tough fight for Raqqa. It's taken 4 months to take the city. But that seemed to be more a case of the fighters who were there trapped without any way of getting out, just fighting for their own lives rather than any big capability on ISIS's part to put up much resistance anymore.
Just seconds left, but the Kurdish forces include a lot of women. Is that embarrassing to ISIS?
It is embarrassing to ISIS. I think it's a bit more embarrassing that they're losing absolutely everything they claimed 3 years ago.
So they're, to some extent, then, genuinely out of business, or not to some extent, but they're genuinely out of business.
At the moment, they've become sort of like almost irrelevant to the bigger political conflict taking place in the Middle East. Everybody's fighting them, but we're already seeing the new wars starting for control of the territories they had, such as we've seen in Iraq with the Kurds and the Iraqi government.
Liz Sly, Beirut Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, many thanks.
Thank you.
In a moment, sports, politics, and patriotism on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Last year, 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick was almost alone when he took a knee rather than saluting the flag. Now, because of his protests against police and racial abuse, he's out of a job. But this weekend, the Associated Press says every National Football League game saw some form of demonstration. Yesterday, President Trump said this:
"It is very disrespectful to our country when they take a knee during the national anthem, number one. Number two, the people of our country are very angry at the NFL."
Today, two meetings behind closed doors. First, team owners with players at NFL headquarters in New York City. Now the owners are meeting separately by themselves. Ken Belson is there outside the door for the New York Times. Ken, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Do we know anything about what happened when the players and the owners met this morning?
Well, there's a bit of a veil of secrecy going on here. They've actually instructed the players and the union to say nothing coming out of the meeting other than a statement, a somewhat anodyne statement, saying they've continued to talk. I mean, the real rub here is whether the NFL will strengthen its policy or even enforce its policy that allows them to fine players Frankly, what I'm hearing from the owners is they don't want to go that route. It's too heavy-handed. It'll only inflame the issue further, and it'll also look like they're giving in to the president. So it's kind of they're boxed in. They do want to hear the players' concerns, but I think it's going to take a day or two for them to kind of figure out how to address it in a more concrete way.
I understand you may have to drop the phone and go listen to the owners when they come out of the room, and we'll wait for you to do that. Maybe we'll get a report once they have done it. But you say they don't want to give in to the president. Aren't some of them big supporters of the president?
Yes, they have a dual issue here. Yes, some of them support him, but he's also called out their players, their employees, their partners, if you will, in the NFL business specifically. So they're in a kind of no-win situation. If they end up siding openly with the president, then, you know, they may lose the locker room, so to speak, and then you might have a walkout of players, and that would be a disaster for everybody. Secondly, you know, look, the president has his own agenda, and you can't allow the business, which has been around 100 years now, to be whipped around based on a single politician, admittedly a powerful one, but one who is, you know, going to be out of office sooner or later. And the NFL tries to look long-term here and stand by the people who are closest to it. In this case, it's the players and the owners. They have to work together on this.
The NFL may always be with us. What about the Players Association? How strongly do they feel about their right to protest?
Interesting. They've had statements about the protection of the First Amendment and so forth, but this is a protest on private property or in the workplace, and so the rules are a little less clear than public or person's right to speak in public. So it's a kind of muddled issue. I don't think they actually want to get into a large fight with the league on this. They have many other issues. At the same time, the union can't compel all of its members to stand. It's beyond the purview of what to do. The union itself is really just involved in contract negotiations and defending players in grievances. But in this case, this is a sort of game day rule. And some of your listeners will remember that players have been fined, for instance, for wearing the wrong cleats or not wearing the uniform properly. The union rarely gets terribly involved with those kinds of things. If there's a player who's suspended, maybe that's a little different. But this is one that's really kind of caught between, and I think the union is trying to be supportive, but doesn't necessarily have the heavy leverage in this case.
Ken Belson with the New York Times waiting outside the door for the owners to appear. We'll come back to you as we go forward with our program. Maybe we'll hear more about what the owners have had to say. In the meantime, here's Todd Boyd. He's a professor of cinema and media studies at USC. He's author of the book Young, Black, Rich, and Famous, The Rise of the NBA, The Hip-Hop Invasion, and the Transformation of American Culture. Dr. Boyd, good to have you back with us.
Thanks, Warren.
You're talking about the NBA, the National Basketball Association. Is there a difference substantially as far as politics are concerned between the NFL and the NBA?
Well, I think those two leagues offer very different cultures. You know, the NBA, you're talking about a team of 15 players. In the NFL, it's 53. The NBA is a league that's predominantly black. The white players in the NBA are often players from places in Europe. Whereas in the NFL, the players are American, be they black or white. Many of the white players in the NFL are from rural areas, small towns, sort of, you know, the areas of the country that voted for Trump. So, you know, you're talking about two very different cultures. The nature of the sports are different. I mean, football is much more violent and aggressive and brutal. And we've seen this recently with the news around, you know, concussions and CTE and sort of long-term disability. So you're talking about two really different entities and two different cultures. But I should point out the NBA has a rule that says the players have to stand for the anthem. This, of course, instituted after a player, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, formerly Chris Jackson, back in the 90s, protested against standing for the anthem, instead choosing to pray he was a Muslim. The NFL says players should stand. They don't. They say they should be on the field, but they should stand. And so You know, you also have to look at the fact that the owners, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, several of the owners donated a great deal to Donald Trump's inauguration earlier this year. But in the NBA a few years ago, of course, here in L.A., there was the case of Donald Sterling, an individual who, like Donald Trump, had been previously sued by the government for housing discrimination. And he, of course, was caught saying some very racist things on a recording, was eventually bought out of his team in the NBA. So two different cultures, but there are some things that connect them when you talk about race, sports, and politics.
We often hear people, including politicians, say, oh, you know, politics and sports really don't mesh. They shouldn't be together. We shouldn't mess up the sports with all these dirty politics. What's the history of sports and politics in the United States?
Well, you know, to talk about sports and politics, you also have to talk about race. In this country's history, some of the biggest most, you know, visible and most memorable examples around racial issues have transpired in sports, going back to the early days of the 20th century with Jack Johnson, the boxer, who becoming the first heavyweight, black heavyweight champion, prompts the emergence of the so-called Great White Hope, Jim Jeffries, who people are recruiting out of retirement to, as they put it at that time, restore hope to the white race. You know, you talk about an individual like Paul Robeson, who was an All-American at Rutgers, but whose name was later removed from the All-American team because he was considered to be a communist or communist influence. Robeson, of course, the great activist, athlete, and entertainer, ultimate Renaissance man, was a politicized figure, and his name would be taken from the All-American list. You know, we could talk about Jackie Robinson breaking the color line in baseball. We could talk about Jesse Owens and Joe Louis back in the 30s and the lead up to World War II. And, of course, in the 1960s, the emergence of the former Cassius Clay, otherwise known as Muhammad Ali, who, of course, would protest the Vietnam War. Now, I've just gone through the 1960s. I could continue. But my point is there are numerous examples in America's history where race, sports, and politics have been uniquely tied together, and what we're seeing now is really a sort of contemporary manifestation of something that's been part of American culture for a very long time.
It seems to me they're virtually inseparable, and you mentioned Muhammad Ali. He didn't just protest the Vietnam War. He refused the draft. As a result of that, he wasn't able to fight during his most prominent years.
Yes, at the height of his career, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine, but, you know, pick a contemporary athlete now at the height of their career being, you know, not allowed to participate in the sport for 3.5 years. Muhammad Ali was not allowed to box. His passport was taken. He couldn't travel. He, in essence, couldn't make a living. He would eventually prevail in court at the Supreme Court and also in the ring. And, of course, when Ali died last year in death, his funeral was a memorial that was on par with the way that we have traditionally honored presidents and other such figures in their death. So over time, Ali's image changed. It was embraced by different people. It was nuanced and edited. But the legacy of Muhammad Ali, I think, is a legacy that speaks to the important connection between sports and politics that's been in place for a very long time.
Todd Boyd, professor at USC. We've been talking about men's sports. There's been a lot more attention paid in recent years to women's sports. Lindsay Gibbs is a reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast about sports and feminism. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Have women athletes picked up where Kaepernick left off, or were they engaged in politics a long time before that?
Yeah, they in many ways started this movement last summer. You know, women have always been involved in politics. You guys were talking about how intertwined race is with sports, and gender, I would say, is too. I mean, it's thanks to Title IX, a political piece of legislation, that so many women in this country have the opportunity to play sports. What you're seeing is last summer, the WNBA players really started this wave of political activism right after Anton Sterling and Philando Castile were both murdered by police officers. So WNBA players started taking the court wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts, which of course NBA players had done in a few separate cases years before. They were, however, the only pro league really going in the United States at the time besides baseball, but we know baseball won't be wearing Black Lives Matter shirts, unfortunately, right now these days. But the WNBA players took the court, they were fined, and then they went on to say, hey, we're not going to accept these fines. We are trying to use our platform, use our voices. They held media blackouts. I walked into the Washington Mystics locker room after a loss. None of the players would talk to me about the game. They were wearing Black Lives Matter, Enough is Enough t-shirts, and they would only answer questions about racial inequality and police brutality. That was all they would talk about. And they did that until the fines were rescinded. Now, this was before Kaepernick took a knee. Once Kaepernick took a knee, you saw a lot of the WNBA players take it as well, sometimes just as individuals, and sometimes you saw entire teams do it. And you also saw white WNBA players taking a knee with their teammates well before any of the white NFL players took a knee.
Has there been any retaliation against them?
Well, there is a smaller spotlight on them, which I think, decreases the outrage. It's not going to be it's not going to garner the attention of the NFL or a Jerry Jones or anything like that. But there absolutely has been backlash. I mean, look, they have to deal the sexism and racism that so many women in the WNBA and homophobia that they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis just for existing is what I would consider an insurmountable amount. I mean, I don't know how any of them do that. I look at their mentions sometimes on social media, and it's horrific. And a lot of them did. You know, there were fans protesting in Minnesota. The Minnesota Lynx, who are a dynasty right now, their officers wouldn't work the game. They said, we're not going to provide security for the game because you're disrespecting the anthem. You know, they used that line. So absolutely they received some blowback. But I will say the league did a really great job of handling this. The WNBA president listened to the players. When they said that they would not accept these fines, she ended up overturning them. And I talked to her at the All-Star Game. This is Lisa Borders, the WNBA president. I talked to her at the All-Star Game this year, and she said she learned a lot from that incident. She learned that she was wrong, that she needs to do a better job listening to the players, and that the WNBA needs to embrace its voice and its social activism, not fight against it. So that to me is a model of what a sports league should be.
And a very unusual story in this political context. Quickly back to Ken Belson. Still, the owners haven't come out yet. And once again, he's covering the National Football League owners and also a sports writer for the New York Times. So what about baseball? Why isn't baseball involved?
It's an interesting question. I mean, baseball, we did have one player kneel late in the season in Oakland. I don't know whether it's an issue of players. It's a more international league. There's many more Hispanic players who may have a different view on the issue. There are far fewer black players than there used to be years ago. And I don't know, the professor was mentioning earlier on your program about many players coming from diverse parts of America in football. I don't know whether that's necessarily the case in baseball. So I don't know yet whether or why it hasn't spread to baseball. Baseball, of course, has had...
Let me interrupt you quickly, Todd Boyd. Why do you think it hasn't gone to baseball?
Well, I mean, you know, when you talk about baseball, you're talking about a sport that's populated by white American players and Latino players for the most part, as well as, of course, some Asian players.
Well, Latinos have certainly been subject to police abuse, at least according to many Latino leaders.
Yes, of course. Many of the Latino players in baseball, though, are not American. They're from the Dominican Republic or Venezuela or other nations. Some of them, of course, are American. So,
I got to interrupt you again because we need to take a break. We're going to do that. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation. And we'll hear more, too, about what President Trump said about the fans. He said the fans are really angry at the NFL. We'll see if there's any indication that that might be the case. On our talking point later, Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen brings a warning from Moscow. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Allen back with To The Point, talking today about sports, politics, and patriotism. Earlier, we heard President Trump say this: it's very disrespectful to our country when players take a knee during the national anthem, number one. Number two, the people of our country are very angry at the NFL. Kevin Coyle is graphics editor and reporter with the New York Times at The Upshot. We're getting double service out of the New York Times today. Kevin Coyle, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You have published a set of graphs entitled, "The NFL is now one of the most divisive brands in the U.S. Where'd you get that?
So we were thinking about how we might measure or how we might quantify the level of interest Americans have in the NFL and how they feel about it in particular. And there's been a lot of polling about the NFL in particular, and I don't want to say that it's inconclusive, but I think a lot of what has been found is sort of like Americans' answers depend on how you ask the question. If you phrase it about patriotism, or if you ask it about the flag, or if you ask about sports in general. But what we wanted to know is just like, how do people think about the NFL in general? And we worked with this online polling group called Morning Consult. We've worked with them before, and what they do is they've been doing this for a very long time. They track, or they have a whole list of brands, like about 1,000 brands that people like you and me use every day. They'll ask people like, what do you think about Ritz crackers? Or what do you think about Levi's jeans? Or what do you think about the New York Times? And most of the time, people they answer the same whether they're Democratic or Republican. But we found where the NFL is concerned, and the NFL and the NBA were both questions that they've been asking survey respondents about for about a year now, is that Democrats and Republicans tended to have an overall positive view of the NFL. It didn't really matter if you were Democrat or Republican. You generally thought favorably of the NFL. But starting in about September, which is right around the time, mid-September, when President Trump made his remarks, I think it was at a rally in Alabama, that those two views started to diverge. And Republicans overwhelmingly say they have view the NFL unfavorably, whereas Democrats, their responses haven't appreciably changed. And the difference between Democrats and Republicans on this issue is now, of all the brands that this company collects, is right up there in the top five next to Trump Hotels, which is an obviously divisive brand. Republicans have a generally favorable view of Trump Hotels, and Democrats have an overwhelmingly negative view. And then a whole bunch of media companies where, again, Democrats view much more favorably. So now, in the matter of a few weeks, the National Football League has basically, like, catapulted to near the top of this list of the most divisive companies and brands in the United States.
Well, there certainly are a lot of Republicans who are football fans and a lot of Trump supporters who are football fans. Do they make a distinction between the sport and their desire to watch it and the politicization of this situation with the President Trump involved? Or can you get that far in the polling?
Sure. So that's a really good question, and it's something that those of us who study polling and write about it are constantly thinking about and wondering about, which is that, you know, even if you say if you're a Republican and you strongly support President Trump, and someone calls you on the phone or you fill out an online survey and they say, do you have a favorable view or unfavorable view of the National Football League? You might say, oh, I despise the National Football League. I can't believe they're doing that. And as soon as the call's over, you're going to turn the game back on. So it's not necessarily a perfect way to measure, you know, exactly what's happening. The other ways we could have to measure you could look at television ratings, but that's also a very complicated picture. Television ratings for the NFL are down, but they're down for every sport. And so it's not necessarily completely conclusive that, you know, this one statement by the president or this issue in particular is really keeping fans away. So I think it's a little bit too early to tell for that. But this one narrow response or this, you know, the survey, these questions are very narrow, but for the signal that we have is very strong in this case, which is that there is a strong partisan split between them, at least in how they answer the question. We don't necessarily know if that extends to, you know, like how important it is among all their other issues that people go to vote about. So
sure.
They answer the question very very strongly, but it's not clear, you know, how much that's going to matter. What people told the pollster, you know, how they filled out an online survey.
All right, Kevin Quayle, again, graphics editor, reporter with the New York Times. Great to talk with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Back to Lindsay Gibbs, because I want to ask this question. Have these protests spread to the grassroots? You're involved with Think Progress, and you've got something to say about that.
Yeah, we've been tracking for a year now the spread of these protests to, like you said, to the youth level, to the high school level, to the college level. We have a database on our site where you can email us if there's some we're missing, and we try and keep it up to date. We're usually a few days behind, but we do our best to continuously update it. And so far, we tracked over 3,500 people have showed signs of protest following in Colin Kaepernick's footsteps at volleyball games, at football games, sometimes at, you know, band events. I mean, you've seen it throughout. Anywhere the national anthem is played, you're seeing signs of protest. Some people just raising their fist a lot more taking a knee on the grassroots level than I would say on the NFL level this day. And it's been incredible to read these stories that are happening in these communities. And I've done some reporting and talked to some of these kids who have been protesting. And it's been a real chance for them to experience what it's like to be on the front lines of such a hot-button issue firsthand. And they're finding their voice. They're learning about how to speak about racial inequality, how to speak about police brutality. They're learning what's happening in their communities. And they're talking to their white teammates about it. Their white teammates are figuring this out, are, you know, coming to these realizations. These conversations are happening. This is a very polarized issue, and you're going to have a lot of people on both sides who aren't willing to have a conversation. But there's some magic happening where these conversations are happening on the grassroots level.
So by grassroots, you're talking about high school kids and college kids. Does this extend to the Midwest, or is it only true on the coasts, or how widespread geographically is it?
We've tallied in 41 states. So that's definitely a lot of the Midwest. I mean, you know, we've seen it pretty much everywhere. There's even one in, you know, the Dakotas, we found one. So it's been pretty incredible to see how much this has taken impact. I mean, you had a senior in Hawaii on a football team take a knee to extend the protest for him to the way indigenous Hawaiians were treated in the country. So you saw a professional soccer team in Germany took a knee in solidarity with the NFL players over the weekend as a way to bring attention to what they were experiencing in Berlin and the discrimination they saw in their community. So you're seeing this symbol really take off.
Lindsay Gibbs again with Think Progress, co-host of Burn It All Down, a podcast about sports and feminism. Todd Boyd, back to you at USC. I understand that the ratings for NFL games on CBS are down about 17% from last year. Do you think that has anything to do with political protest?
Well, I think, there are probably a number of factors that might explain that, and that's really a small sample size to judge. People have been talking about declining ratings for the NFL for a while, even before the protests began. But, you know, there's a lot of attention being placed around this issue, and I'm sure that some people, for a variety of reasons, have not been watching games. I should point out, this is not a one-sided issue. It's often the case in our society when angry white people decide to complain about something, it's taken seriously. But if other people complain, it's ignored. There are different opinions about this. There are many African-Americans, for instance, who have decided to boycott the NFL this year because they disagree with the way that Kaepernick's been treated. And so that's an issue, and that may influence why someone chooses not to watch the game in the same way that someone else might be potentially offended by the sight of a black athlete choosing to, you know, express their position as it pertains to this particular issue. So it's not just, you know, Trump voters and Trump and the right who's, you know, outrage. There are people on the other side who feel as though Kaepernick's been blackballed, and they're not watching the NFL because they feel as though watching sort of supports this entity that has denied this African-American man an opportunity to express his First Amendment rights.
So as Kevin Quayle told us, the NFL has become a divisive element in our society. I want to go back to Ken Belson. It's waiting outside for the National Football League owners to come out, if they ever will, before our program is over, for the New York Times. How worried are the owners about declines in television ratings? That's how they make their money.
Yes, it's their bread and butter. I mean, the owners receive about 70% of their revenue every year from television contracts and sponsorships, a little bit of merchandise sales, too. It's in the order of billions of dollars. But as the professor said, there's a lot of reasons why there's been an erosion in ratings in the last few years, and it's not simply this protest issue. It's hard to divine all of that. Some of it's just demographic changes. Younger viewers aren't sitting in front of the TV the way they used to. So they're definitely worried. This issue is one that they have not encountered, and it's why there's such focus on it. I mean, the issues that we've had in previous years, like the bullying issue in the locker room, domestic violence, in many ways, these are issues that the NFL was to blame for. This is another issue in the sense that the NFL actually let Colin Kaepernick continue to protest and other players to join him. And in fact, just seem to be wishing it would just blow over. Their focus over the years has been, their promise over the years is that once the playoffs start and we get in the hunt into December, into January, most of America forgets about all these ancillary issues and really just focuses on the games. In this case, they couldn't do that. Even in the years when domestic violence was a serious topic, by playoff time, most fans had started to focus on the games. Here, the president keeps inserting himself into the conversation. And so they're really, again, caught between a force they can't control and the other force they can't control, which is the players. And this really has to come from the players, the solution. And I don't think the owners can sort of paper this one over.
I want to go back to Todd Boyd with this question. You mentioned the importance of race in this situation. Once again, of course, Colin Kaepernick has lost his job for what he has done. Now we have the head coach of the San Antonio Spurs in the NBA, Greg Popovich, who is not, of course, African-American, calling The Nation magazine and calling Dave Zirin of The Nation. Popovich, a veteran of some standing, saying, "This man in the Oval Office is a soulless coward who thinks he can only become large by belittling others." He called him a pathological liar, unfit intellectually, emotionally, and psychologically to hold the office. Do you think Greg Popovich will lose his job?
No. Greg Popovich is not going to lose his job. Greg Popovich has been very vocal in his criticisms of Trump for some time now. He's been especially direct in his comments. And what's interesting to me is, you know, Trump is very quick to attack people he considers weak. He's not said a word about any of Popovich's comments, and Popovich has made several comments by this point. I'm not aware of any response from Trump at all. So it seems to me that Pop, as you pointed out, a veteran, Air Force Academy, it seems like Pop wants Trump's attention. He wants him to respond, and Trump's not saying anything. So when you look at his success as a coach with the Spurs, he's been incredibly successful for a long period of time. He's been particularly instrumental in incorporating foreign players into the game and achieving success with them. Of course, the Spurs had the great Tim Duncan for many years, and so Pop's been successful, and he's using his success and his visibility to come out against Trump, which is a very different position than a lot of other people in the position have taken.
Lindsay Gibbs at Think Progress. We know what has been reported with regard to the president, his Access Hollywood tape, bragging about groping women and that sort of thing. Have women athletes turned on the president the way that Coach Popovich has?
Absolutely. WNBA players all summer spoke out against him. Elena Deladon, who's one of the best women athletes out there, spoke out specifically against his transgender military ban. You had them attacking policies. They linked arms and protested during the national anthem after the Charlottesville attacks and after his response. Megan Rapinoe of the National Women's Soccer League and a member of the U.S. Women's National Team, she started taking a knee. She's a white player, but she is gay, and she started taking a knee last year saying, look, I felt discriminated by against my country, and this is my way of showing solidarity with African Americans and with minorities who are discriminated against. And she's been, I just saw her speaking out against Mike Pence's comments about gay people yesterday. So a lot of these women athletes are continuing to take the torch and to speak out. There's no shortage of reactions and of activism.
Ken Belson, back to you with the New York Times. Kaepernick is suing the NFL, claiming the teams have colluded against him. Once again, they're meeting behind a closed door now, and you're outside the door. But are they taking that seriously?
Yeah, they have no choice to. To be precise, he's filed a grievance under the labor agreement as opposed to suing in open court. But even so, the bar for Kaepernick is very high on this. He's got to actually prove that multiple teams have conspired against him, and that's not easy. But it's a continuation of a very public debate getting more public. And if he loses in arbitration, he may take it to court, and then it's another round of bad publicity for the league, even if the league ends up prevailing. And, you know, there's something I wanted to add to what the professor was saying about Greg Popovich. You know, the context or the background for Donald Trump attacking the NFL is that he's for many years wanted to own a team and has never been able to, going all the way back to the 1980s. And so there's a kind of perverse jealousy that he has. He's been able to be elected president, and he's been unable to own an NFL team. And so I think he's taken a particular interest in the NFL on that level, but also because the NFL has the widest audience and appeals to many of the people who voted for him. But there's a personal angle to this that I think is unexplored.
All right. Sometimes you have to make choices in life. Do you want to own an NFL team, or do you want to be president of the United States? It's great to talk with all of you. Ken Belson with the New York Times, Todd Boyd at USC, author of Young Black, Rich and Famous, The Rise of the NBA, The Hip-Hop Invasion, and The Transformation of American Culture. Lindsay Gibbs with Think Progress, co-host of the Burn It Down podcast about sports and feminism. Kevin Quayle, our graphics editor and reporter with the New York Times, told us how things are going in terms of fan response. Thanks to you all very much. In a moment, Masha Gessen with a warning from Moscow. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen has a warning for Americans in her new book, The Future is History. Yesterday on this program, she argued that when the Soviet Union fell, substantial political and economic reforms did not follow. And she says that caused tremendous social unease that Vladimir Putin has taken advantage of to cement his control. It's much like Hitler rose to power. She put it this way.
There are times in human history when people feel so uncertain, the future seems so unclear and so unpredictable, that freedom becomes an unbearable burden.
So are Americans facing a similar uncertainty, and does that partly explain the election of Donald Trump? I began this part of our conversation with a question about a common misconception about the Soviet Union. Communism was notoriously atheistic. And yet religion seems to be very important to the kind of totalitarianism that you now see in Russia. Why is that the case?
Well, that's a great way of putting it. I'm glad that you said notoriously atheistic and not just atheistic, because I don't think it was atheistic. I mean, first of all, the myth that the Bolsheviks destroyed organized religion is a myth. They subjugated organized religion, but they instrumentalized it. They didn't have to do a lot because under the czars, the church was also instrumentalized. But basically, the Bolsheviks and the Soviet regime used the church strategically whenever they needed to mobilize the population. Most remarkably, during World War II, when the church priests were sent out to recruit and to motivate the troops. So something similar has been happening over the last 20 years or 30 years, because the church has been there both to sort of to offer people certainty when the regime took the certainty away, but also the regime has worked hand in hand, or even I would say in total symbiosis with the church. It's very difficult to tell them apart. It's a little bit like saying, this is the right hand and this is the left hand, but they're attached to the same body. And of course, it also helps that both Vladimir Putin and the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church hail from the KGB. So they come from the same corporation, they speak the same language, and they use a lot of the same tactics.
You don't mention the United States much in this book, but in other places at other times, you have warned about what might happen in this country. Tell us how you think what's happening here resembles in some way what's happened in Russia.
You know, it's the strangest thing, because I set out to write a book about Russia. And then when I finished writing it just over a year ago, I sort of looked up from my desk and thought, oh, my God, I've just done a lot of relevant research. I think, obviously, the United States and Russia are very different. And a lot of what I write about has no relevance to the United States, in the sense that, I write about something that happened on the ruins of a totalitarian society, and so has called forward the habits of a totalitarian society. Here we have something completely different. But it is remarkable how much of Trump's appeal, I think, has parallels to Putin's appeal, especially this idea of an imaginary past, which he offers as a prize to people who are feeling disoriented, uncertain, and really, burdened by their own lives beyond the point where it can be bearable. And he sort of says, okay, come with me. We're going to go back to an imaginary past, and you're going to feel comfortable and certain once again. And that psychological trick is exactly the same as what Putin has done. I think it comes to both of them naturally. Neither of them is smart enough to think this stuff through. I think they both long to go to that imaginary past as well. I also think that there are major similarities between them in how they mobilize people, how they instrumentalize hate, how they lie in very particular ways to assert power. So it's odd how, despite all the differences between Russia and the United States, I think there's actually quite a bit in this book that will resonate with people who are sort of shocked by the ascension of Trump.
You said earlier that in Russia, the horrors of the communist past were never really confronted, and that led to a kind of weakness and, I take it, vulnerability to what's happened since. We hear in this country a lot about how, even though we had a civil war, we haven't really confronted the evils of slavery, and consequently racism still exists in very brutal forms. Do you see an analogy there?
I do. I mean, I think that I've actually been amazed at how at the parallels there, because again, I spent a long time thinking about the need to create a national narrative that everybody can buy into after something as awful as a war or a revolution. And a lot of the debates around monuments actually have sort of odd parallels. In Russia, post-communist Russia didn't remove the monuments to communist leaders. And within a few years, you started hearing objections to any attempts to remove them because it's our history. The thing that happens when you say that and you take that position is that, it's at first glance, it seems unassailable. Yes, of course, it's our history. But the question is, how do we approach that history? What is the distance that we have from that history? I mean, you can keep a monument in place and frame it in a way that illustrates or that showcases the narrative that the country has adopted, right? And that's something that hasn't happened. Lenin stands, you know, this enormous statue of Lenin stands in one of the largest squares of Moscow, sort of unchallenged. And so his greatness is unchallenged. And it's no accident that when Ukraine had its revolution in 2014, one of the first things that happened was that they started raising Lenin monuments, because they needed to do that to sort of to move forward with their own story. So I think there are some echoes of that that lack of critical distance to history, or in the case of the United States, you know, revisionist history that was created in many southern towns and cities many years after the Civil War, right? That the argument that this is our history doesn't address the need to frame that history.
Do you see signs in the United States of the kind of national trauma that you talked about in Russia?
I think that would be a stretch. The Russian situation is unique. Russia has had the longest-running totalitarian regime. I mean, totalitarian regimes are a 20th-century invention, but the one that lasted the longest and arguably is once again sort of emergent is the Russian regime. And the kind of damage that that does to people and to the fabric of society, I don't actually think can be compared to anything else. It's a whole other thing.
I would take issue with the idea that totalitarian regimes were invented in the 20th century, though. What about ancient Egypt? What about some of the other empires of the past? They were certainly totalitarian.
No, they were tyrannies. They were not totalitarian.
What's the difference between a tyranny and a totalitarian state?
So Hannah Arendt writes that a tyranny, the difference between tyranny and totalitarianism is that tyranny demands certain behaviors from people.
Right.
But it basically otherwise leaves them alone to form their own opinions as long as they behave in accordance with a given set of rules. Totalitarianism really aims to dominate the whole person and to rob people of the very ability to form opinions. And in that sense, to her, tyranny doesn't take away all that space or, you know, the personal space that people need to feel their autonomy. And totalitarianism does. To her, totalitarianism is miles worse than tyranny.
The book is The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. The author is Masha Gessen. Many thanks.
Thank you very much.
I'm Orman Alney. To the Point is produced live and podcast by KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.